Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Members, this morning, we have a review of the biennial budget for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And we also have the post-board's budget, and we have one bill, House File 458, Representative Mullery. We are going to have maybe a five-minute presentation on the deficiency bill that's coming before the Finance Committee that has some implications to the Public Finance Committee. So with that, let's start with the Sentencing Guideline Commission, and Isabel Gomez is here. You can present your budget if you would.
Thank you, Chairman Kamer. I know that you're short of time this morning, and ours is a very simple and straightforward request.
We actually have time.
Oh, you do? Well, it's still going to be simple and straightforward. I have with me this morning Ann Wall, who is the most knowledgeable person in our agency by far, and Lee Meadows, who's one of our researchers and IT person. And that's half the staff. Because you graciously gave us an opportunity for an overview of the agency, we can go directly to the request. Basically, the motif or the theme here is pretty simple. It's restoration and maintenance of the commission's historical level of resources. We're requesting $600,000 per year for the next biennium. That would be an increase of $137,000 per year, a total increase of $274,000 for the biennium. The governor's budget specifically recognizes what our needs are, and you have before you a printout of the agency profile together with the portion of the governor's budget related to the Guidelines Commission. The governor's budget requests that what we'd be allowed to do is to maintain existing functions and to return the agency to the level of capacity of the 2000-2001 biennium. We have a slide here which shows you the agency's budget, which is the vertical lines, the columns, against the number of felony sentences between 2000 and 2005. And what you see is a very sharp decline in 2004 of the agency's budget, together with an increase in the number of sentences that the staff was required to analyze. That's just one measure of the growth of the agency's work, but it's one that's pretty clear, and it seemed a good one to show you. There's another slide that's basically the same point in a table form, and that shows the base budget for each year from 2000 through 2007, together with the number of felony sentences. What you see is that in 2000, the budget was $567,000. There were about 10,395 felony sentences for the staff to analyze. And in 2005, which is the last complete set of data that we have in terms of number of cases, there were 15,482 felony sentences, and the budget was $463,000. If we were to stay at that present base budget, we would not be able to fund our present 5.75 FTE in the next biennium. In order to try to create a viable budget within the base of $463,000, I budgeted by cutting back my position to 0.75 and cutting the total FTEs to 5.5 as opposed to 5.75. Even when I did that, I could not get the salaries within that budget. In 2008, we would be able to fund it at about 99%, and in 2009, we would be able to fund it at about 96%. The fact is that the agency can't run with 5.5 FTE and that it is certainly not a good idea to have a director, whoever the person may be, who is there, who's not there full time. Our entire request is for salaries. And it basically is in two pieces. One is to fully fund the people that we now have. And that and the other larger piece, $247,000 over the biennium, is to get the capacity back to what it has historically been. In fact, it would be less capacity per case than it was in 2000-2001, but honestly, I believe we can run the agency appropriately at the budget that we're requesting. We would, first of all, raise one of the present staff in level. We have a staffer at intermediate research level who is consistently working above grade. And that is both illegal and unethical. She needs to be paid for the work that she's doing. And the choices are either to have this increase so that we can bump her up a level, or somehow I could try to make her less efficient, which does not seem to me to be a good management approach. Then we would add two research positions. And I do want to note parenthetically that that the agency has not really been running on $463,000, because at the time that the agency budget was cut so substantially, the legislature also appropriated, I'm not sure exactly how much it was, it's kind of hard to figure, but I think it was $100,000, that we have continued to spend we're in our fourth year of using that money. Of course, it's not efficient to have that sort of carryover spend down kind of money because we can't use it for salaries. I have used it, chunks of it this year, for temps and for consulting to get people in that way. We aren't able to use temps well because we have to have really highly capable, dedicated people, and the learning curve in the agency is really high. I want to explain that we have no receptionists, we have no administrative assistant, we all answer our own phones, we do our own copying. If we have a big project like the reports of the legislature, we all pitch in on it. And that's because, as I said, we cannot afford to employ anyone who does not substantially contribute to the rather complicated daily work of the agency and who does not fully involve himself or herself in the mission. Now, I have thought, you know, when I put this presentation to you together, that I might have been overly modest in the budget request. I mean, maybe it was a folly to ask for what we truly, truly need and not what we would love to have. Some people said to me, you never do that. You always put a cushion on because they are not going to give it to you. And I didn't take that advice. I have to be credible here. The agency has to be credible here. And I really respect the difficulty of what you have to do. Representative Cornish at a PrimNet meeting not very long ago made some remarks which really got something across to me. You know, we come here, which I wouldn't have understood really without what he said, so I told him I appreciate it. We come to you and it feels as though I'm begging, you know, from this all-powerful entity that has the capacity to kill the agency. And so, you know, we come here really cognizant of your power. And what Representative Cornish transmitted in those comments is that you don't sit there thinking of your power. You sit there thinking of your responsibility to spend the people's money wisely, and that's a tough thing to do. And so I came to you in the overview, and I asked
You missed the glowing compliment that
yes.
Ms. Gomez just put.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I came to you in the agency overview, and I said that if the state made a modest investment in research, you could get a big return. But really, it would be irresponsible of me to come in here with requests for venture capital and requests for money that would allow us to create a new, more capacious research institution. That's not what I'm doing because, frankly, it is my responsibility to make sure that this agency persists, that to build up the foundation and to stabilize the situation before we go off on anything beyond that. And again, I really have asked you for what we really do need. As a footnote, I will say that the governor's budget gave us what we asked for. There's a difference of about $12,000 between our request and what the governor included in his budget. And we could use the $12,000, but the difference is that we figured the growth in salaries and benefits at about 3.5% annually because we were advised that that was realistic. And the governor figured it at 2%. And that's what accounts for the difference between our request and what made it to the budget. I want to show you one last slide. And this slide shows our budget allocation against similar agencies across the United States. The black bar is Minnesota. We're just to the right of Alabama. And those pinky orange bars are the commissions that are very comparable to us in reputation. And those are Virginia, Washington, I have them by heart, but Virginia, Washington, Kansas, and North Carolina. Those commissions have the kind of reputation that Minnesota has nationally, and you will see that all of their budgets are substantially higher than ours. Oregon, I've always considered to be to be a fair comparison with us as well, but somehow they have got major bucks. I'm not sure what they're doing that, you know, is special, but I didn't feel that was a particularly good comparison because they're so much higher than the other comparables. I'm a Minnesotan. I am not asking you for this agency to get an increase that bumps us up, you know, even to the middle. Everybody who works in state government or has worked in state government knows that it is an ethos of Minnesota to get bang for the people's buck, and that people who work for the state in any capacity typically do not earn the national median or average, much less the high end. And I'm not asking for that. If we were to, and that's fine with me, I think it's worked very well for Minnesota. And if you give us the full request, which I really earnestly hope you will, we would vault over Alabama by a little. So we, you know, you would not be taking us up there on the range of similar agencies. And we would continue, I think, to deliver what Minnesotans expect from their state servants. I'm going to stop with that. If you have questions, I, of course, will do my best to answer those.
Thank you, Ms. Gomez, for the presentation. I'm just curious, in that last chart, do you know the other states, if they provide, is it general fund appropriations to fund the similar kinds of commissions, or do they get their resources from other places?
My understanding is that typically it is general fund, direct funding from the legislature. I'm not aware, now there's Pennsylvania, which is the second one from the left, has an unusual situation. It's unusual in a number of ways, which is why I haven't made it a comparison with us, because it really is not so comparable. And given the complexity of that particular organization and the way it's split up, they may be getting some funding from fees or somebody other than direct appropriations.
Representative Eastland.
I just had a question on the transfer. Is there a reason why Kansas...
Representative Eastland, can you pull your microphone down, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gomez, is there a reason why Kansas is over there kind of sticking up by itself, why it isn't over in between the two that where it fits?
Ms. Gomez?
I honestly can't answer that, Representative Eastland. I don't know the histories of these agencies' relationships with the legislature. All I know is that they all, those colored bars, all are very well respected nationally, and that they have the same kind of influence that we tend to have in the National Association of Sentencing Commissions.
Okay, then I was just talking about the makeup of the graph. It just looks like one bar is in the wrong place there. But
oh, I see what you're saying.
I don't know why
that is.
Okay.
The other
question, it wasn't nearly as significant of a question as you thought there, but the other question I have is, how does compensation, I noticed on one of the other slides, you kind of use the, offender population, you kind of compared that against the base budget. How does the number of offenders affect the work of your agency?
That's a great question. In reviewing these slides, I thought we probably should have put sentences as opposed to offenders. That number, 15,482, is the number of felony sentences. So it's not the number of people incarcerated or in prison or anything like that. And the reason that it affects the work is that the staff collects data concerning every sentence and inputs that data into our data bank in various forms. Each of those sentences has to be reviewed for accuracy and cleaned to the extent that there's some sort of anomaly in the way it's transmitted to us. Sometimes we could see that on its face it does not make sense. And then the staff has to go back and figure out and contact people to make sure we're entering the right data. So each of those sentences has to be processed, and that's the relationship.
Can I have one more representative, Eastland?
To kind of understand how the different graphs that you have in here relate, I know that we are a fairly low incarceration state.
Right.
But how does the number of sentences in our state compare to other states? Do we have less sentences as well here that are dealing? So I'm trying to get at the workload as we compare, the different states. Is there something we should know about the workload, since other states incarcerate many more people, sometimes two or three or four or ten times as many? How does that relate to the need for compensation here?
I'm sorry, Chairman Paymark.
We're taping, Ms. Dallas.
Pardon?
We're taping, that's why we have to go
sorry.
Through the chair.
Representative Eastland, I do not think that Minnesota's level of felony sentences imposed, people convicted, is particularly remarkable. Our incarceration rate is. So certainly our incarceration rate is lower than Kansas, than North Carolina, or than Virginia. It is not, I think, appreciably lower than Washington. I mean, it's somewhat lower, because we're always wisely on the low end of that. Again, we should have said probably sentences imposed. I think in terms of the number of crimes committed, our crime rate is lower. But our crime rate includes primarily serious offenses. I mean, those are the ones that are tracked, as opposed to fleeing a police officer and so on. But that's a complicated issue, and I don't know the answer. But it is not the kind of differential you would have if we were looking at processing only the sentences of incarcerated people, because we're processing the sentence of anybody who appears in court and is convicted of a felony. And most of those people do not go to prison.
Representative Liebling.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gomez, first of all, I apologize for coming in a few minutes late, and I want to ask you a little bit about what I kind of came into in the middle of, and I apologize if you're repeating it. But first, I just want to say that I really appreciate your being very straightforward and not padding your request and all of that. And that's helpful. I really think that this is a very important, that the commission is very important, and that the work that you do is very important to the entire system. So with that, I just wanted to ask a little bit more about the additional personnel that you're requesting. And if I got this right, are you requesting, I think you said two, maybe you could write two more FTEs. And what I was intrigued when you were talking about that you don't have anybody who's just secretarial or just a receptionist and just does copying, and you seem to be liking it that way. But I wonder whether it's really efficient to use your high-level people. You're wanting to increase somebody's salary because they're performing so well and all of that. It kind of reminds me about when I've talked to public defenders, one of their problems is that they've got public defenders who are doing copying and doing data entry, and it's not efficient. So could you talk about that a little bit and how that fits with your request for more people, and what, I don't know if you already discussed this, but maybe what salary level you're talking about for those new FTEs?
Ms. Gomez.
Yes, I think Chairman K, my representative, that is a very good question, which is raised by my comments. And the fact is that the amount of copying that we have is not that big. So the reason that people answer their own phones is because when people call the agency, they want information and they need to talk with a researcher. So if we have, the agency sometimes has had a sort of receptionist, then what happens is that person answers the phone and transfers the call to somebody else. And it seems to me that's not very efficient, because inevitably the person who calls wants information. They want to know, usually, how the guidelines should be applied in a particular case. And it's the researchers and who know that. So if we had somebody doing copying, there would be some weeks where they wouldn't do any. So it isn't that we have a large volume of that kind of routine office stuff. The volume of the work we do is research and analysis of data. The positions, let me see, I've got, I do have those broken out. They would be, as I'm presently looking at it, would be salaried at $35,000, something in there. And then, of course, there is the additional cost of supporting those positions. And I have that here. Let's see. That would cost about $44,000. Probably less than that, actually. That's an intermediate person. Somewhere between the total cost of each position would be somewhere between $40,000 and $44,000, depending on where we, you know, where they came in. I don't know if that's fully responsive.
Representative Friedland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gomez, it's partly responsive. I guess I'd like to know just a little bit more about, that's great, but so who are these people that you would be hiring? Are they people that come in with a bachelor's degree or what?
Presently, our researchers, three of the four have master's degrees, and the fourth has a bachelor's degree and many, many years of experience, both at the commission and at the Supreme Court. I think we get a lot of bang for our buck. I think it's, we have very dedicated people. They really care about what they're doing, and they bring their master's degrees and work happily with us.
Thank you.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Gomez, does the commission receive any funding other than the general fund appropriation?
It does not.
Ms. Gomez.
Now, the commission has in the past, pretty early on in its history gotten grants to do certain kinds of research. I mentioned in the overview that the commission is dedicated to doing the racial disparity research, and all of that I'm trying to get private funding for. So if we get the funding for the research, that would be private funding, not additional money from the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Judge Gomez, has the commission ever approached the legislature or considered assessing some type of a fee or surcharge to felony convictions in order to fund some or all of the commission's work? I'm thinking of, I know we have all kinds of various fees and surcharges on convictions. There's a law library charge and things of that sort. Has that ever been considered?
Ms. Gomez?
I'm going to check, if I may, Chairman Paymar and Representative, with Ms. Wall. Do you know anything like that? I checked, as I said, Ann Wall is the person who knows more about the agency than anybody else. I'm not aware of any such attempt. It'll be, you know, it's an interesting question, Representative, because I know that when the Post Board presents, they get quite a lot of, or some part, I don't know what proportion, of their funding for such fees, and so you might be having a discussion about that there, but we never have done that.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think that's something that we at least keep in mind. If there's a way that I assume that it's permissible that we could attach some type of a surcharge, and if we're dealing with 16,000 some felony convictions in a particular year, $10 a pop, we're talking about $160,000. I mean, even something relatively modest in terms of a fee assessed. Now, of course, we may not be able to collect all of those. I recognize that, but we may be able to help the commission make up some of its budget that way. I don't know if there's any reason we couldn't do that. I don't know if staff, if there's a reason we couldn't, I'd love to hear it. But
Tiger, do you have a?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, just maybe what I should just point out is there are certain fees right now on all convictions, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, and felonies, and we're going to get into those, I think, with Representative Mullery's bill. But you have the fine, and then you have a $72 surcharge on top of that. And in Ramsey County, it's $73. And then, as you said, too, there's a law library fee that ranges from $5 to $10. And also, I think on the felony convictions that were pointed out by the public defenders, I think they represent about 70 to 80% of the felony convictions. So just some information on that.
If I may, Chairman Paymar.
Ms. Gomez.
I think that, the commission does not have any position on how the state raises its money. I would just ask that this year, when we are so close to the bone, we not be forced to rely on collecting money from felons, because we really need the money for sure. Now, in the future, if the legislature wanted to assess such a fee in order to support research, projects, that's a different thing. But we really need every penny of this request this year.
If there's no further questions, thank you, Ms. Gomez, for your presentation.
You.
The chair notes that we have a quorum present, and before we bring up the post board, Mr. Carger, could you just, let me just say, I just want to ask if there's any questions. There's a finance, there's a deficiency bill coming before the Finance Committee, and there are four items that relate to public safety finance. Did you make copies of this? Do members have copies of this? They don't. Okay. Let me just review these real quick. I just want to see if there's any issues regarding, just so you, this when this comes up on Monday. The Board of Judicial Standards is going to get $90,000. Maybe I'll just have you, Gary, walk through the four of these, if you wouldn't, Section 3, 4, 5, and 6. And if members have questions or issues, we should talk about them before this deficiency bill comes before the Finance Committee. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, the deficiency bill is, it's Host File 958. It also is in your budget books, and I can give you page numbers in the budget books. They're all governor's recommendations, and these are deficiencies for this current fiscal year. The first one, and by the way, I think we heard about the, at least three of the deficiencies during the hearing, during the hearings when the agencies testified. The first one is the tax court, and that can be found on page 6 of your budget books. Under the tax court, they're asking for $47,000. There, they're running their salary and operating costs. They have run out of money to pay for their, they paid for their salary, so they have run out of money, so they have a deficit of $47,000. The next one is the Board of Judicial Standards. And this one I don't think we have heard of. They're coming up, I believe, next week. And they have two judicial disciplinary proceedings going on. And they, I guess these proceedings, they have requested hearings, so the Board of Judicial Standards, they just, their funding basically is just for FTEs, and they have to pay for the hearing costs, which are attorney's fees and transcript costs, you know, as, items such as that. And that's for, like I said, $90,000. The next one is the Board of Public Defense, and we heard about that one yesterday. In fact, I think Mr. Kyer is in the audience if there are any further questions on that. That's $200,000 for transcripts for fiscal year 07. Once again, they ran out of money for those transcripts. And the last one is the Public Safety Department, Emergency Management. And this is the large request. It's $1.107 million. And this is the for the state match for federal funds, and it's for the Red River Valley flooding that took place in 2006. Those are the four requests, Mr. Chair.
And members, I'm having the memo from Representative Carlson made copies, so you can have you can see all of these deficiency requests. I just want to know if there's any comments or questions about these requests.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know if there were any deficiency requests made to the governor that were not included in the bill? And if there were, why they weren't?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no, we do not. That is information that when the agencies make the request to the governor, it's private information. In the past, sometimes the committees have asked for that information, however. But right now, we do not know.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you intend to request that information?
Representative Hillstrom, it was not my intent. If you would like me to request that information, I would.
Mr. Chair, the only reason for asking is, as we put together the budget, I want to make sure that we are putting together a budget that actually funds going forward and not making up for things that should have been funded in this deficiency bill. So if you're comfortable with where we are, I'm comfortable, but I want to make certain that we are, you know, taking care of whatever deficiencies there are, so we're starting fresh with our budget.
Maybe we can take a few minutes to Representative Hillstrom. Mr. King, can you, would you mind responding to Representative Hillstrom's request for information?
Mr. Chairman, while he's coming up,
question,
what's the timing again? Remind us of the timing that the deficiency bill will be before this committee and when you anticipate it will be on the floor of the House.
Representative Smith, it will be before the Ways and Means Committee, I think on Monday, and then it's going to the floor.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jim King from the Department of Finance. I'm Executive Budget Officer there. I'm not aware of any other deficiency requests that under the purview of this committee that came to the that came to our attention during the process.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. King.
Any questions?
Okay. All right, let's move on then. And Mr. Melton, do you want to come up and present your budget? We do have a bill that's related to your budget, so... So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, commonly referred to as the POST Board. Today I'll cover the agency overview as well as the budget overview. And to those of you new to the House, you may not have even heard of the agency. We're one of the state's best-kept secrets. We're small, but we're vital. To assist in my presentation, you should have a four-page handout with this cover sheet. That will provide additional details as I proceed. My brief comments will consist of three components. First, a review of exactly who and what the POST Board is. Secondly, a few words on the how and why of the Board's role in state government. And lastly, the POST Board's budget and the Governor's recommendations. The POST Board was created by legislation 30 years ago. Minnesota was the first state to license their peace officers. As part of that enabling legislation in 1977, the legislature also crafted the mission of the POST Board. That is, to enhance the profession of law enforcement in Minnesota through the selection, education, licensing, and regulation of peace officers. That's no small task considering we have 475 state, county, and local agencies, and over 10,200 licensed peace officers in Minnesota. One rationale behind the POST concept is that the state has a vested interest in guaranteeing law enforcement is professional and consistent in Minnesota, from Ada to Zumbrota, for agencies large and small, rural or urban, those with considerable resources, and those agencies with very limited resources. All citizens, regardless of where they live within the state, deserve the very best public safety services we can provide. I call your attention to the first page of the handouts. This is called POST Board's Key Service Components. And I really believe that verbs tell the story. These are a number of the things that the staff takes care of. We manage a licensing program. We create and administer licensing exams. We develop, maintain, and publish learning objectives for the 21 colleges and universities that provide the peace officer education. We certify peace officer education programs. We approve continuing education courses for law enforcement. We monitor compliance of CE requirements for peace officers. We administer a training reimbursement fund for law enforcement, and we will speak to that in more detail a little bit later. We establish and reinforce minimum standards of conduct for peace officers. We oversee law enforcement agencies' compliance to policies and procedures. We promulgate rules. And we monitor board-specific law enforcement-related legislation. We provide technical assistance to colleges and universities. We participate in countless meetings, conferences, task forces, etc. We respond to many, many requests from the media for interviews, answer constituent questions on a day-to-day basis, and other services as mandated by the legislature. Page number two of your handout reflects the POST Board constituents. These are our stakeholders. This is the list of people with whom we work on a regular basis. And as you read down the list, it's the citizens, the governor's office, the legislature, and I mentioned 475 state, county, and local law enforcement agencies. And just to break that down a bit, there are 365 local police departments in Minnesota, 87 sheriffs, 9 non-municipal police departments. That's like the Metro Transit, the Airports Commission, the University of Minnesota, and so forth. There are 8 tribal police departments, as well as 6 state agencies. We've got a number of professional law enforcement organizations that we interact with, the Chiefs Association, the Sheriffs, Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, State Patrol, Conservation Officers, Association of Women Police, and other agency-specific federations and so forth. The next item is the higher education, specifically the 22 colleges and universities that offer this law enforcement degree program. In Minnesota, a 2-year college degree is the minimum requirement. Like I said, there are 22 colleges and universities. 2-year and 4-year institutions, both public and private. It's a very big educational venture in Minnesota. We also interact with other state agencies, other government-related agencies such as the League of Minnesota Cities, Minnesota Counties, Association of Townships, and so forth, special interest groups, community groups, and the media. It's interesting on that post-grad constituent, the agencies that are listed there range in size from one officer to 828. That's Minneapolis. Interestingly, 10% of the agencies in Minnesota have one officer. 10% of agencies in Minnesota only have one officer working. 40% have seven or fewer. Now, seven is significant because that's the number that's required to provide 24-hour coverage 7 days a week. That's the minimum. So you can see our agencies in Minnesota are small. And there are 15 agencies in Minnesota that employ over 100 officers. Those figures showcase a challenge the Post Board faces. That is, how to be both a regulator and a resource to such diverse agencies. And a similar challenge faces you as well. Legislation is a broad brush. Laws that are passed apply equally to all agencies, whether they have one officer or 800 officers. Of the 475 agencies in Minnesota, that's a reflection of today. By this afternoon, that could change. Policing in Minnesota is evolving. Since 1990, over 100 agencies in Minnesota have either consolidated, contracted for services, or simply disbanded. That transition from local police departments to regional agencies is a fascinating study and one that Post monitors very closely. Post will continue to work with its constituents and stakeholders to help communities that consider consolidating, contracting, or disbanding. In that context, we are really the resource for local units of government. Page 3 of the handout talks about the Post Board membership. There is actually a board of 15 members appointed by the governor for 4-year staggered terms. The membership is defined in statute, and the specific positions include the superintendent of the BCA, whoever occupies that chair is a member of the board, 2 police chiefs, 2 sheriffs, 4 peace officers, one of whom must be a trooper, 2 former peace officers who are currently faculty members in the college programs, 1 college administrator, 2 public members, and lastly, the most specific category, that is, an elected official from a community outside the metro area with a population of less than 5,000. Currently, that member of the board is a city council member from Vernon Center. And that Post Board membership, the 15, also reflects my collective boss. Page 4, the funding. Since 1998, Post has been funded solely from a special revenue account from a surcharge on certain criminal and traffic offenses. The original surcharge in 1998 was $25. The surcharge today is $72, but the Post Board share is still a portion of the original $25. More details on that in the next presentation as well. The Post operating budget and the money it reimburses to local units of government for training costs come directly from that special revenue account. The fund currently generates a little over $16 million a year, and the authorized distribution percentages are shown in the shaded block at the top of that handout page. That is, 1% of the monies go directly to the DNR Game and Fish Fund, 39% is authorized to go to the Post Board, and 60% to the General Fund. A closer look at those percentages reveals the 39% figure for the Post Board is actually the maximum authorized by statute. Post's actual budget is set by the legislature. And since 2002, the authorized 39% has actually been somewhere between 27 and 22%. Of what Post does receive, over 75% of that money is returned to law enforcement agencies and local units of government in the form of reimbursements for police training. I call your attention to the table of figures at the bottom of page 4 of the handout packet. As you can see, the per officer reimbursement share has decreased since 2003. And actually has been reduced by 24% since 1989. That's 18 years ago. Certainly, while training costs have increased in the past 18 years, the reimbursement dollars have decreased. The per-officer share, the very right-hand column of that table, represents money sent directly to law enforcement agencies in your districts and has a direct bearing on the amount and, in some cases, the caliber of training your officers receive. Now, before we move into the budget section of my remarks, allow me to share a few thoughts about why POST, a licensing and regulatory agency, performs a unique public service. One of the basic functions of state government is to regulate the practices of various professions. It began with medicine, law, education, even barbers. I'm not sure about my barber, but most of them do. The goal of regulation is to protect the health and welfare of citizens. That's the basis. Underlying that responsibility is the belief that regulation improves public service. POST's regulatory component is a straightforward responsibility and based on statute and rule. It's a rather black and white process, regulatory. However, the resource role that POST provides is less clear-cut and requires more creative thinking and certainly problem-solving. As the POST Board partners with law enforcement to fulfill legislative and administrative rule directives, the board and staff members are cognizant of finding an acceptable balance between our dual roles of regulator and resource. POST is an ever-evolving agency intent on searching for new and innovative ways to improve law enforcement in Minnesota. The POST Board strives to assist Minnesota's law enforcement community to better serve and protect the people who live in, work in, or merely visit our great state. Now, on to our budget presentation, and I call your attention to your budget book. My pages are numbered 1 through 4, and to assist me is none other than Dan Boydum, our Executive Budget Officer from the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chair, do we have the same pages, numbers 1 through 4?
Mr. Melton, yes. It's... Well, we have 1 through 8. Eight. 1 through 8.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Sir, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Boydum. I'm with the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety provides the fiscal services for the Post Corps.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Page 1 is just the cover sheet. Page 2. Excuse me?
Go ahead. I thought he was going to make the presentation.
No, well. Mr. Chair, he's to clarify things that I confuse.
Go ahead.
So he'll be speaking shortly, I'm sure. Page 2 of the handout packet is the agency profile, and I covered most of those items in my opening comments. However, at the bottom of page number 2 is the budget. Again, the Post Board is funded through a special revenue account. The FY 2007 budget from this source was $4,214,000, and the resources were allocated as follows. The reimbursements to local units of government, as I described, $3.1 million, or 73% of our budget, and our operating budget is $1.1 million, and the Post Board currently has 12 full-time employees. Page 3 is the contact page. Page 4. The agency overview. For 06, 07, $4.1, $4.2 million, respectively. The governor's recommendations for 08, 09, $4.2 million, $4.2 million. But a recommended change, $23,000 in 08, $46,000 in 09, and I will get to that on the next page, what those figures represent. The next item is the expenditures by fund. Direct appropriations are the special revenue accounts, $3.9 million and so forth. The next item is unique and it's a bit new. Statutory appropriations, miscellaneous special revenue. In 06, $185,000, in 07, $225,000 were receipts from a non-DUI related driver's license reinstatement fee. Non-DUI related driver's license reinstatement. Those figures are projected to bring in $250,000 per year in 08 and 09. At the bottom of that page 4, the full-time equivalent positions at posts, 12.2. The .2 is a part-time college intern. Please note our staffing in 2003 were 15 full-time equivalent positions, so we have lost 20% of our staff. Page 5 is the summary of the change items. Again, under the change items, the operating cost increase is for rent, communications, attorney general, statewide and direct costs. Expenditures that we consider non-discretionary. Below that is the compensation adjustment for salary based on new contract languages. The increases are $5,000, $18,000 in 08, $10,000, and $36,000 in 09. You'll see at the bottom of page 5 as well that miscellaneous special revenue, again, is the revenue from the non-DUI related driver's license reinstatement. Now to more specifics. The change item on page 6 reflects the operating cost increases. The increase to the special revenue of $5,000 reflects a decrease of the same amount to the general fund, $5,000. The recommendation is that the governor recommends $15,000 from the special revenue fund to pay for operating cost increases to the agency. As I mentioned before, the agency continues to experience cost increases for operational expenses, such as communications, supplies, and equipment, all that are necessary to maintain our licensing and other service-related issues. The relationship to the base budget is that the recommendation will increase non-compensation operating funding by approximately 2.5% per year. It will also reduce the transfer to the general fund by that same amount. On to page 7 to talk about the compensation adjustment. Again, there will be an increase to the special revenue fund of $18,000 in 08, $36,000 in 09, and there will be a similar reduction to the general fund for the same 2 years of the biennium. Under the recommendation, the states the governor recommends additional funding for compensation-related costs associated with the delivery of agency services. That amounts to an annual increase of 2% for personnel costs. And that, again, is to maintain current staffing levels of 12.2. As I mentioned, we've lost 3 staff members in 5 years. Each year, the compensation costs rise due to labor contract settlements, insurance, and other items such as pension obligations and step increases. And we did not have that discretionary funding left in our budget. The other paragraphs on page 7 reflect boilerplate language that you've seen with other small agencies across the state. The very last page, agency revenue summary. We bring in money. We have licensing fees, exam fees, renewal fees, and they do change from year to year, and that's based on our licensing renewal cycle, where one-third of the peace officers in Minnesota renew their licenses every year. It's based on the alphabet. And the alphabet is not cut perfectly in thirds. Some are higher, some are lower. It just changes from year to year. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is our budget. Any questions for Mr. Boyden?
Okay, Mr. Melton, Representative Lesh has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Melton, or whomever. Question is, you mentioned that you certify peace officers for the 300-odd municipal police departments, 87 sheriffs, and then 9 non-municipal agencies. You mentioned that Airport Police, MAC, Metro Transit. Can you rattle off the other 7?
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the non-municipal police departments in the state of Minnesota, the Metro Airports Commission, the Metropolitan Transit Police, the State Fair Police, Minneapolis Parks, Three Rivers Regional Parks, Anoka Parks, and there are 3 U of M police departments.
Okay.
The Twin Cities, Morris, and Duluth.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Melton. And actually, this is a comment for the committee as well, and it may not necessarily be something that Mr. Melton is familiar with in terms of jurisdiction of all these departments, but I am curious about it. Ever since I got pinched for speeding on Highway 5 in front of the airport without going in the airport, wondering what's the jurisdictional limits of these guys here and why they're raising funds on Highway 5. So anyway, Mr. Chair, I think it's a worthwhile topic for the committee. That's all I'd say.
Representative,
did you pay
it? Representative, he should have found a good lawyer or something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the driver's license reinstatement fees. How much money does that amount to, that and what part of your budget is that?
Mr. Mountain.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr.
In 2006, that fund generated $185,000. In 2007, current year, we're projected to bring in $225,000, and the projection then for 2008-09 is $250,000 per year, and these are for non-DUI-related driver's license reinstatements.
Okay, so those are only for non-DUI-related?
Oh, pardon me, Mr. Chair.
Those are only for the non-DUI-related driver's license reinstatements.
Mr. Mountain.
Yes, sir.
Representative Eastman.
I have just one kind of a concern. You can tell me how this fits into your revenue stream if it does. When an inmate is released from prison and they have a driver's license reinstatement fee hanging over their head, are those fees, if they're non-DUI related, are they collected by your agency?
Mr. Boynton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, the non-DWI reinstatement fees are collected by the Department of Public Safety. Depending upon that ex-con's reinstatement, it's possible these could be that, but it's dependent upon the reasons for the reinstatement. These reinstatements are only non-DWI.
Okay, Mr. Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair, I mean, that's an area that I think we should look at. I mean, when someone is released from prison and they're given $100 and they have to pay $600 to get their driver's license back, there's some hurdles that we put in front of people that are really, really difficult. And it's something that we should kind of think about. And if it affected your budget, it would be. I don't know how many it actually affects, but it's an issue that I've heard quite a bit about, and I think it's something that maybe we could look at some point in this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Boynton.
Eastland, the non-DWI reinstatement fee, I believe, is $20. So that $600 fee you're talking about is more likely a DWI reinstatement, and the Post Board does not get any of that. So that's a different issue.
Representative Haas? No? Okay. Well, let's, Mr. Boynton, maybe you could, do you want to... Representative Cornish, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't hold my hand. It's okay, I didn't hold my hand up till just now. Just a quick comment for the consideration of the committee when we're going over this budget. When I was hired as a cop in 75, if you were from a municipality under 1,000 people, you didn't have to have any training whatsoever. In fact, when I got hired, it was by the mayor in his living room, and I rode around with the chief for one night, and I was given a gun and handcuffs and radio, and that was it. If you were from a municipality over 1,000 people, then you were required to go through the BCA 8-week course and be certified. And it was just optional for under 1,000 in 1977 when we come to all these regulations. And my point here is that now we go through unbelievable training, a two-year degree, and this is the first contact that we have where a lot of our complaints come from if we don't have our police officers trained well, and the continuing caseload that comes up and the appeals, the protection of people's rights. And I know a lot of the committee here is worried about peace and justice, and this is the first contact for people of color that you're worried about, the protection of rights of different minority groups, and everything balloons from here. So if we have well-trained officers, the system starts out working right from the start. So if we keep that under consideration as we progress. So thanks.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Any other questions of Mr. Mountain? We'll have you back up here to respond to or to Representative Mullery's bill. So, Representative Mullery, do you want to present your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think Mr. Mountain might as well.
Yes. Representative Mullery, you have an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move my bill first, 458, and then amendment DE2 to get it in the shape we want.
Representative Mullery moves House File 458 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And then, Representative Mullery, do you want to speak to your amendment? Move your amendment, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think I moved my amendment, DE2.
Okay, and moves to the DE2 amendment to House File 458. So it's now in the shape that you want it. Representative Mullery, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, first I think
I'll...
All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Mullery.
Somebody's been around a long time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think first I should explain what this does. The 458 was drafted the way it would appear in the eventual bill coming out of committee with the chair and the committee, and where it has the $6,554,000, that would be the overall amount for the post board, and that will depend on whatever the chair and the committee decide on. And then this, my amendment would just appear as a rider under that, setting forth specific amount to go to the peace officer training account. So that just kind of explains what's happening here. This, it wasn't originally quite drafted right. So what we would be then indicating would be that roughly $5 million each year for the post board training account for training officers. And I think that's what, if everybody understands that, that's what we're trying to do here. And it's what this is it's a training account, is a reimbursement to local units of government, and it's on a, it's assigned on a per office per officer basis to defray the costs that law enforcement agencies have for training officers. And I think it's important to remember that in the last few years, especially, most cities in the state have received large cuts in LGA, and also had a lot of them had school tax increases, and so it's making it harder to fund from the property tax system. So we're trying to, in this situation, we're trying to bring up the post board to their statutory 39% of the first $25 of the surcharge. And there's varying amounts that that cities get back, but I thought it was interesting looking at, I just looked at the members of this committee and how much their cities get back, and the longtime member of the committee gets the most, Hermantown. But I think that, actually, probably fortunately, he did it better than I would. Mr. Melton explained almost every point I was going to make. The difference where we've gone from 1989, where it was 477 per officer, to 362 in 2006, despite the huge increase in training costs. And I think that Representative Cornish brought out some of the importance to many of us, such as the they're trained now in using, there used to be training in use of force, now they're being trained in less lethal use of force. They're receiving a lot of cultural training nowadays. Big importance is especially to many in the metro area, the inner cities and the inner ring suburbs, is the youth intervention that they are receiving training in. And of course, nowadays language skills is enormous importance, and that's being, they're receiving training in that. Then of course the new drugs, they have to receive training in that. So there's a lot of new things that come on. And there's one of the reasons it's costly is because, I guess, it's often 1-4, 1-5, 1-6 training rather than a lot of the continuing education courses that many of us go to, which, like for attorneys, we may go to a course that's got 300, 400, 500 people in it. It costs more to do that, and I think it's very important to keep our police up to date on these things, so we're just trying to reimburse part of what the cities are incurring for this. Do you have anything that you want to add to that?
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, every year before the reimbursements are distributed, we survey the agencies and ask them to send to us their figures for what they spent on the course fees, salaries. It may be backfilling an overtime position for an officer to go to training. It may be a regional training where they have travel, per diem, lodging, meals, and so forth. And on an average, we are reimbursing less than a third of what they're actually spending, and yet the training is getting more costly every year. And as Representative Mulry said, these are low student-teacher ratios. We're teaching psychomotor skills out there in firearms, use of force, and we do a lot of cross-jurisdictional training with fire, EMS. We have to do it outside in the real world. These are not passive learning environments in the classroom, but these are outside, normally done in nice weather in the summer, cold weather in the winter. We have them using fire towers and doing building searches, and this is an expensive training. But from my conversations with my colleagues across the nation that have other post boards or similar, we are still the model. We have the finest peace officers in the nation. There is no question. And I see the results of officer actions across the country, officers getting in trouble. We have so little of that in Minnesota. We have so much to be proud of, and I think it is directly related to the amount and the caliber of training that they receive.
Mr. Melton, what was your request to the governor for the next biennium?
The post board did not make a specific request to the governor that appeared in the recommendations. Our request was 39%.
What dollar amount was did you request from the governor for the next biennium?
Mr. Chair, as I recall, we just asked for move up to the 39% that was authorized, not a specific dollar, because the revenue changes annually.
The 39% of the first $25 of the surcharge. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, the 39% of the first $25 of the surcharge is what they were asking for. That's what the statute authorizes, and so they're asking for what the statute authorizes. And the estimate of that isn't out yet, I don't believe.
Mr. Miller, I was asking Mr. Melton about what his budget request was. I'm just trying to get at this. It seems to me, if I'm reading this correctly, it would mean a $2 million, basically a $2 million appropriation or pull in the general fund to do this, and I'm just wondering if the governor the concept anyway. Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chairman, just
$2.4
million in 07, $2.5 million in 08. The increased appropriation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, it has been changed. It is now $2 million increase, and the reason for that is that right now the fund would not support anything over the $2 million. I think there's an excess of like $26,000 in there. So that's why it would be an increase of $2 million each year in that training fund.
Martin, you want to respond to my question, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the request was not in the governor's recommendations.
Representative Murphy, Dominguez, and then Sellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulder, I'd like documentation. I would like you to share your documentation around the table. And Mr. Melton, Representative Mulder was saying about how, and you were saying about how we have new things coming before you that have to be that the police officers have to be trained in, and some of that is probably because of us even, because I went to a meeting in northeastern Minnesota in November for the deaf and hard of hearing people, and it was kind of a speak out in which they were talking about their problems with government, their problems with the media, and their problems in society that they had, and they talked about problems that they had with various police officers, and these were individual experiences. And then afterwards, the facilitator and I were chatting, and she said, "What can we do about that?" And I said, "Well, talk to the post board, because they're the ones that train the police officers, and they would consider bringing this to the police officers' attention." And I think that has since taken place, or it is very shortly going to take place. And so that's how we keep adding things that they need awareness of, and that's why we need more dollars in the training bucket. And so if we expect changes to be made, then we have to give opportunities for the people to become aware of the changes that are needed.
Put you on the list here, Representative Cornish, unless it's to this exact point.
Just to this point, which you brought up about the sight and hearing, for just a real life experience, to give you an idea. Real life experience, an officer pulled up behind a car, or a man was changing a tire. A man got up from the car with a tire iron in his hand. He's deaf. He can't hear. Turned towards the officer, started walking towards the officer with just a regular look on his face. The officer had to make a decision. He said, "Stay where you are. Stay where you are." He had no idea. He kept walking. Officer had to make a decision what he's going to do, draw his weapon and shoot that man, or let him continue on there at that point. So this is why we need things like this pop up, training. Now that officer should be trained what he's going to do or she in that specific instance. And things like that pop up all the time, and then the bulletin goes out. Maybe we need training here or there. So just know what we're talking about.
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little bit you asked the question that I was going to also ask about the governor's budget. But also I want to ask the question as far as Murphy and Cornish mentioned also was the training that officers really need, and especially in my community where you have so many things going on with some mental health issues that's happened already in our community with the Somali community, that they had some mental health issues and officers had to restrain. In fact, they killed a person. But the other issues, I guess, that I've been hearing from my community is training with sensitivity. How officers react to communities of color. Either it's training that probably need to do something with the cultural barriers or language barriers, those issues, and I'm glad someone's taken forward in doing these things. But also, I just want to make mention that in my community there's a kind of a push for officers to understand the relationships with communities. Is there going to be any training within communities that really need a push for communicational efforts?
Mr. Mountain?
Do you understand, maybe?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, maybe I can make a broader statement but address your concerns within that. First, to be clear, POST doesn't provide training. We are not a trainer. We approve training. The training that we approve is brought to us in an application format for post credits by chiefs, sheriffs, other private vendors, and we have some police chiefs in the audience that could probably give you specific information about what they want to do or what training they think their agencies need. And it varies from across the state. There are certain needs in certain areas of the state, and a lot of them deal with cultural issues depending on the region and the state. And they are reaching out within their communities to find leaders of those minority communities to work with the police to develop specific training for their specific area. The two mandated training areas for law enforcement in Minnesota that are legislatively mandated are use of force and pursuit driving and emergency vehicle operations. Once those are achieved for an officer within their 3-year licensing cycle, the remaining credits can be made up in any area that the chief or sheriff or officer believes they need. And we have heard time and time again across the state there's a need for training in policing immigrant communities and whatever title you want to give it. And law enforcement, I know because I've seen the applications come in for courses, are moving heaven and earth to find instructors, courses, good learning objectives, make it a valuable learning experience. So that is going on every day.
Representative Zach.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for Chair Mullery or Mr. Melton, on your bill, Chair Mullery, there's a technology improvement for $140,000, and we're talking about radios in some places, and there's bills floating around, and I'm just curious if you give any idea of what the $140,000 is, if it's computer updates or tech that, whatever it may be. I'm just curious what that money would be for.
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chair, the 2005 legislature was kind enough to authorize POST $140,000 to upgrade our computer system. Then things started to fall apart on us. We got the money theoretically in the bank on July 1st of 05. As we were moving to get a single source contract to enhance our computer system, because we're a small agency, so we have to rely on Department of Public Safety for computer support, their IT people. At the same time, they said they could no longer support our system, so we had to move and get a new system. Then we were told that this new organization called the Drive to Excellence and Office of Enterprise Technology was taking over all state computer requests, so ours was then put on hold and said you cannot do your own, you have to be part of the larger group, which made sense. Then our staff person retired. They did all the data entry on that computer. And we have become, I hate to use the word victim, but we can't get out of the way of the state right now. So we've had the money in the bank for, well, over a year and a half. We can't spend it. And so it looks as though at the end of this year that will simply cancel back to the general fund because we are now part of the Drive to Excellence Office of Enterprise Technology computer program initiative. Our individual initiative no longer is valid. That money's in the bank, but you're getting it back.
Representative Zach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just asking what it was there. I'm sorry to bring up that. obviously bad. An open wound there.
Oh, shit.
It has been a part of... Mr. Chairman, just I thought I clarified, maybe some of the members missed when I clarified that before, when I first started, that this is not part of the bill, the original bill. It's a delete-all. Representative Zellers was working from something that is replaced, deleted. So.
But, Mr. Chair, I was happy to get that off my chest.
We were happy to hear it.
Okay, are there any other...
Mr. Chair, did you want... I know we're short on time. We did have a couple of... was it from Duluth and Bloomington? There are... I'm not sure if it's chiefs or officers. Chiefs, I believe, from Bloomington and Duluth, if you want them, but it's kind of... If you had questions about what they use it for, basically.
Did they come to testify today? Did you want them to testify?
They came to be available to testify.
If you want to give them a few minutes, that's fine. We have time.
Okay.
We want to meet the new chief from Duluth. We want to meet him.
Please, sir, can you please introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is John Locks. I'm the current police chief in Bloomington, and I come today wearing a number of hats. I am the former executive director of the Post Board, so I have some historical perspective. I'm a board member from Minnesota State Chiefs, and I'm also the current president of Hennepin County Chiefs. So I come representing a broad constituency. I'll try to keep my remarks brief, but the bill that you are hearing is not fluff, it's not extra, it's vitally important. Let me put that into some perspective for you. A lot of things have changed since I was executive director of the Post Board in 1995. 12 years ago. Field-based reporting, 800 megahertz radios, computer programs, tasers, drugs that have evolved from coke to meth,
new cultures, new languages that we are expecting our officers to learn, medical protocols that our officers are now expected to put in place. This is just a short list of the things that are required now and have evolved over the last 12 years. Unfortunately, one of the things that has not changed are the dollars that have been made available. You just heard the testimony from Representative Mullery and from Mr. Melton. In 1995, the Post Board reimbursement to local agencies was $380 approximately. Last year, 2006, it was $362. That's 12 years. Regular rate of inflation at 3%. That's 36% increase in the cost of doing business, and we've actually lost dollars. We've lost over a third of our buying power for the same dollars. We're not even breaking even. We're losing ground every single year. The agencies need the training. It's not a luxury. Most of the money that we use goes for mandates that the legislature has imposed. These are good things for law enforcement for us to do. But those of you that have been around this body for a number of years know that a lot of times laws are passed, the money does not follow. We somehow have to make this work, and we do. We stretch our dollars. We combine agency training. We do train the trainers so we can get the best efficiency. We share the resources, we share training centers, and we specialize as much as possible. But this profession is getting very complicated. We expect our officers and deputies to give legal advice, render life-saving help, counsel juveniles, keep the vulnerable safe, arrest drunk drivers and drug dealers, protect battered women and children, neutralize explosives, apply force fairly, and be masters of technology and computers. And again, that's a short list. I could lull you to sleep with all of the things that we are required to do, not that we think we should do, we're required to do and should do. The cost covers only a fraction. Let me again put it in perspective. Half of the counties, the money that you provide covers less than 20% of their training expenses. Half the counties in the state. When you start talking about local jurisdictions, 146 of the local jurisdictions, that money covers less than 20% of their training expenses. Another 68 local jurisdictions, it covers between 20 and 30%. So already we're talking well over 200 agencies that this money covers less than a third of their expenses. For example, in Bloomington, my total training costs for last year were $570,000. That's 7.29% of my budget. Its reimbursement was $41,000 of $570,000, 7.9%. Minneapolis, they spent $2.8 million and got $295,000, 10%. St. Paul, they spent $1.4 million, $197,000, or 14%. The rest of that, we have to, as administrators, figure out where that money comes from. And guess what gets cut first? Training. Historically, on any agency, 80% of my costs running the Bloomington Police Department are wages, salaries, and infrastructure. One of the few things I have any real control over is training. So I want to make the point that this is not extra money. This is grassroots, necessary money. Thank you, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Chief Locke. Any questions? We have two more presenters.
I just wonder if we could go to the beat cop next.
Captain Duluth. Sir, can you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Gordon Ramsey. I'm the new chief in Duluth. And my age has come up a few times. Actually, I'm 72 years old. I just drink a lot of Lake Superior water. So if I can speak in tangible terms of our budget in Duluth, our budget for the police department is about $16 million. And of that, about 93% is salary and benefits. Our training budget is exactly what Post reimbursed us, which last year was $49,000. Of that $49,000, $26,000 goes to pay for our bullets for our mandatory training. Last year we spent $18,000 on emergency vehicle operational training for our officers. That was mandated, I think, in 01 or 02. Over the last few years, we've spent about $40-some thousand in the emergency vehicle operation training for officers. It's required every 3 years. That wasn't required previous to a few years ago. So that has taken a huge bite out of that budget as well. There are a lot of things that I would like to do with additional training money that we don't have. We had an in-custody death of a Native American last year. I met with the Native American Commission in Duluth last night, and we need to do more cultural awareness training for our officers. And I have been going around to the different bands throughout the state to see if I can get donations for this, volunteers. And really, we should have the money available to do this important training. The other major thing that we need to get on board with is training for dealing with the mentally ill. And in Duluth, we have a large, being the regional population center, we have a lot of social services there, so we deal with a lot of mentally ill people. We need to increase our training for our officers in that as well, before something happens. As well as community policing training and other issues such as in-car cameras. We've made a determination to put cameras in our primary squad cars this year. We're coming up with that money by not buying more squad cars. We're going to use the cars a little longer. So there's a lot of things we'd like to do if we could boost this training fund up. Our training fund for the Duluth Police Department is just what Post reimburses us. So thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony, Chief Ramsey, and congratulations on your appointment. And final testifier.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Let me just take a slightly different approach. I agree with both of my colleagues here on all the comments that they have made. Let me just lay out to you what we are concerned about from the sheriff's perspective as the road to the future. Currently, what has happened is that we have gone to and fulfilled the mandated training that we are required. But the extra training that is necessary to lead into the future is not there. We are a democratic society. We are a group of people that live voluntarily by understanding and obeying the laws. And when we do not have, as police officers, community support, our efforts are in vain. We need that community support, community trust. We are not the only ingredient to getting that. It is the courts, it is the legislature, it is the state. And when the public sees public safety not being well trained and the priority, I believe the community supports the relationship between our people and ourselves as the enforcement arm of the legislature suffers. And we are not doing as much as we could to build that up. Secondly, because we are only fulfilling the mandated training, we have a void in the leadership training that needs to carry on the next generation of leaders that are coming up, and we're not doing as good a job of training them in strategic planning, budgeting, and all of the other kinds of things that we should be doing. And the direct correlation of my comments is this. When we don't train, what we do see is increased complaints and increased calls for internal affairs cases. And guess what? We've seen over the last year and a half an increased call by our law enforcement agency asking for more trained people on internal affairs. Folks, we got to invest the money on the front side of doing it right, not on the back side of investigating what's wrong. When we do an IA file, we find one of three things. Number one, the officer either did it wrong because he knowingly did it wrong. Number two, there wasn't a policy, there wasn't a procedure, we hadn't had that situation before, it's new, it's something that we haven't dealt with. Or three, there's a training gap in the interpretation or the misapplication of the policy that is existing. It's one of those three things that we normally come up with on every IA file. So to that end, we encourage your support for increased training. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Representative Moore, you want to
just one quick,
finish up?
Just one quick thought for everyone when you're considering this. Don't we really want, when we see him out in the field, don't we want Representative Cornish well-trained?
Oh, I'm going to afford it.
Representative Zellers, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, and just one quick question as we leave, maybe it can be for next meeting. Representative Liebling and I were looking down the list, and if we could get a copy of Representative Mulry's list. And Representative Mulry, you don't have the highest percentage on there, but I'm not going to tell you which committee member it is. It's not Representative Murphy.
Oh.
We were wondering about the, and I was just making sure it wasn't me not listening to the testifiers, but how that percentage and how the reimbursements, how that comes out. And I asked Representative Liebling, and she didn't remember it from the hearing, their testimony. So if there's a formula, because I know some of them are at 100%, but they're under $1,000, and how that reimbursement is either the percentage comes about, it can be a memo afterwards or whatever. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thanks.
And Representative Mulry's conclusions weren't exactly correct.
Mr. Melton, would you provide that information? Where did he go? To the committee. Representative Mulry, do you final word here? Do you want to?
No, Mr. Chairman. I think everybody understands it. I think it's obviously something we need with the changing requirements we're making of police officers.
Okay. So then the chair will lay over House File 458 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Just one real quick before you go. I did want to make an announcement. At the Judicial Center tonight, Dr. Doug Marlowe, who is one of the top drug court researchers in the country, will be speaking at 4:30 if you're interested in attending. Is there any other business before the committee? If not, this meeting's adjourned. Thank you.